Got it?
The girl is straining against invisible ropes. She snatches the ring, lets it lie there on her open palm.
More weight, she says. That's just what I need.
Wear it, says Chindelin. A shrug, a snort. She puts the ring in her pocket, starts to turn away again. Chindelin catches her hands. They turn to fists, rock hard, unyielding. So it is these he kisses goodbye. The door by which they exit leads to a second tunnel, far longer than the first. Stilts, with a three-warrior escort, guides them with the stump of a candle, which a draft blows out near the tunnel's end. Then a ladder, a small trap door. When they surface at last, it is through the floor of a grain silo, quite hidden from the road. Dawn is breaking. Scores of tuhu birds sizzle in the underbrush, feeding on ants. A woodpecker rattles a cardamom tree. In the east, beams of gold are spilling over the dark mass of the Arig Hills. They pass swiftly through the well-tended farmyard, over a field jagged with the snapped bones of last year's corn. The path winds into a second arm of the ravine. Although he looks twice the brother's age, Stilts is agile, moving quickly through the stones and clumps of pincushion grass. After 100 yards, he beckons to one of his men.
These farmers kept the dog inside. They did everything we asked. Send them a ham, a decent one, not some rancid leftover. And tie a goddamned bow around it this time, will you?
A bow, sir.
Yes, sir. It's the little touches, boy.
Stilts turns to the travelers.
Well, you heard the general. He's arranged something for you, but you'll have to get yourselves as far as the hills before the scythe drops below the horizon. You're certain you know the scythe?
Everyone knows the scythe, says Eshet.
And that is true. The zigzag constellation is one of the brightest in the Urathi night.
Remember what he told you. It's gone before midnight this time of year. By the gods, don't push your luck. He promised you'd find nothing if you came late, and the general damned well means what he says.
We won't be late, says Condry. But you'd better tell us where this hermit lives.
Stilts smiles.
Don't worry. She's a hard one to miss.
He leads them on, and after several minutes, they find a low spot in the ravine. They scramble up the embankment and force their way through tall grass. Before them stretches the wide Lutaral plain. Half a mile to the south rises the city wall, black and enormous, but Stilts points east to the Arig Hills.
Look there. 4 round hills like babies' buttocks, see? And to their right, a gap, and then a taller hill standing alone. That's the hermit. Don't climb it, for the love of Ong. Round it to the east, until you come upon a little wall of field stones. One of us will meet you there.
The hermit's just a rendezvous point?
Precisely. More skulking and sneaking, says Chindelin. Tell me something. Are you a company of men or rats?
We're rats when necessary, says Stilts. Rats are good at staying alive.
Mr. Stilts, says Condry. What's waiting for us out there?
The older man's lips compress to a line. He looks at them a moment, then turns his face away. A moment later, faint sounds reach their ears. Condry turns and sees Mektu scrambling up the side of the ravine. At the bottom stands a young woman in a plain desert canute. She gives Stilts a silent nod and turns away. Condry scrambles down the slope to meet his brother. Mektu is sweaty, disheveled, as though he too has been awake all night. He smiles at Condry, misses a step, winces, but the smile never leaves his face. Condry tries to take his arm, but Mektu waves him off.
I'm just fine. Stop making a fuss. But listen, brother, something's not right. I think we've stayed too long.
It won't be much longer, says Condry.
Not much longer is too long.
His fixed smile is disconcerting. Condry thinks of how he smiled in Eternity Camp, breaking the news about the spring offensive.
You're with me, aren't you?
Condry had felt heartless, turning on his heel, leaving the question unanswered. But what choice did he have? What answer could he have given but no? Lean on me, you're hurting.
Forget it, Khan.
They emerge from the ravine, and Eshet pounces, lifting Mektu's shirt. The wound is angrier than ever.
You should have let Khandri help you, she snaps.
Mektu glares at her. Then he breaks into a little dance, shuffling in his army boots, clapping his hands above his head and singing.
I've known sorrow and pain and nights in the rain, but I've loved my share of ladies.
Stilts waves desperately for silence, grinning despite himself. Eshet does not grin.
More than your fucking share, she says.
Mektu stops as suddenly as he began. The little caper has exhausted him.
Nephew, says Chindelin, that wound is bad.
Mektu is shocked, not by the diagnosis, but by the smith's concession, at long last, of the bond they share.
It's bad, he says. Yes, uncle, it's bad. But I have this feeling, you see. We should run. We should stop asking anyone to help us and run. As for this,
he touches his side, twitches sharply.
I'm going to lance the fucker and be done with it.
Spoken like a peasant, says Khandri. Cut it open, bleed it clean.
Gods, Mech, don't you remember anything from Arikina's clinic?
Says Mektu.
Oh, yes, I remember. You can be sure I do.
Khandri tenses. His brother has a gleam in his eye. He is going to say something vile, something vicious, and they will have it out right here in front of Stilts and his men.
Eshet places a hand on Mektu's cheek. She leans close, eyeball to eyeball.
Don't touch your wound, she says. Promise me. Let the doctors take care of you.
Khandri turns away, fighting for calm. Her gentleness, his uncle's gesture, these unsettle him more than Mektu's provocation. They are frightened for his brother, too frightened for the usual scolding.
Where's this doctor, Mr. Stilts? He demands.
Relax, boy. We're on our way.
Stilts rests a hand on Chindelin's shoulder.
You and Eshet must go back to the farmhouse. Our sister down there will show you the road. Pull your things together and pay Yehida Chen. Be generous. She's a loyal supporter, but she still needs to live.
He gestures at Khandri and Mektu.
These two should be along by midday if all goes well. If it doesn't, you'll need to go to town and buy provisions for four.
What sort of provisions, exactly? Asks Chindelin.
Stilts narrows his eyes.
Water, he says, as much as you can carry, and new fosca of bison or camel skin. Dry food, better head scarves, bone meal, black limes, dates, and figs.
Desert provisions, thinks Khandri. Why not just come out and say it?
Set out well before sunset, says Stilts. You'll need 3 hours to reach the hermit by foot, and one more to round it in the dark.
He gestures to the brothers.
Come along, you two.
The travelers look at one another. Orange light in their eyes, blue flies buzzing their faces. Chindelin scratches one bulky shoulder.
Till midday, boys, he says gruffly.
Khandri nods.
Till midday, uncle.
Eshet looks at each brother in turn. She frowns, as though biting back some impulse, then gives Mektu's hand an awkward squeeze.
Do as he tells you, she says, and come back healed.
She turns away, and Mektu's hand rises a little of its own accord, reaching after her. Although the northern gate is closer, Stilts takes them around the wall once more to the east.
You've yet to pass through the Dawn Gate, he said seriously. That's a bit of good luck you don't want to spurn. Not where you're going.
In the morning sun, the red-orange stone is even more beautiful, glowing with an inner fire. The guards are many, however, and as the three men approach, they rise and step forward, lowering their spears. Khandri nudges Mektu to keep his eyes downcast.
We're in your hands, Stilts. Ong's tears, I hope you know what you're doing.
But as it happens, the Naruman does nothing but smile. As soon as the guards catch his eye, They raise their spears and step backward. No one speaks. The brothers hesitate, but the older man pulls them on. Breathless with relief, they pass through the iron gates, under the glowing stone. Condry stops. A chill is passing over him, from his spine to the tips of his fingers. It is not the chill of fear, but it is deeply strange and unsettling. Mektu's eyes have gone wide. Stilts looks from brother to brother.
"You feel it, then?" he says.
Yes. What is it?" The chill energy has not left him yet. Stilts turns them by the elbows, making them look back out through the dawn gate. Between the market tents, Condry sees the sun rising over the plain and a flock of egrets lifting, and the black, jagged line of the Aurigs. His heart races. He is breathless, overcome by the immensity of what is out there, the infinite distances, the world he has never seen. And suddenly he is eager for it all.
"The gate's blessing," says Stilts.
"Everyone feels it the first time, if they're still young enough, that is.
I guess you're young enough."
"And this is why you brought us here?" Condry asks.
"I brought you here to save your brother from septic agony," says Stilts. "And because my general's so ordered."
He glances meaningfully at the guards, still carefully ignoring them.
"You'll be paying 68 true gold for that little service, by the way. Let's be off."
They follow him into the city. Condry is thinking of Tabasa's ledger book. How deep in his debt are we sliding? How many ways will he collect? Mab Makutin remains in shadow. The sun has yet to clear the wall. Few lamps, dark doorways. Nothing stirs in the alleys between the white clay homes.
"Mr. Stilts," says Mektu. "Why do they call you that? Were you in the circus as well?"
"Hmph," says the older man. "Someone's been talking."
"Not true," says Mektu. "But you know the girl, our crazy girl, and with a name like yours."
"I worked for the circus," says Stilts. "Quite a few of us did. Mansari walked the tightrope. He was our balance boy. Spider climbed like his namesake. Walls, poles, stacked barrels, towers of chairs. He and Talupeke's sergeant performed as a team. She learned from both of them. And her grandmother, Kereka, made it all happen. She was our founder, manager, bookkeeper, mistress of ceremonies. And her knife work was flawless. She's never been equaled, although Tal herself might get there one day. We called her Tapu, the pole at the center of the tent. But enough reminiscing, by damn. That life ended a long time ago."
"At least you had a life," says Mektu. "Condry and I have never gone anywhere. We've never done a fucking thing. How could we, when nothing happens in the valley? You don't know. It's just horrible. People get so bored, they fuck donkeys. They throw strange things in the fireplace, hoping they'll explode. Go on, tell us more. What did you do in the circus?"
Stilts gives him a sideways glance. "I took care of the freaks," he says.
They follow the main avenue for several blocks, then veer into a side street. Now at last there are signs of life. Men and women unlocking their storefronts, fanning coals under blackened tea kettles, chalking their doors with prayer symbols for a day's prosperity.
"Mr. Stilts," murmurs Condry, "why didn't Black Hat tell his men who we were?"
"That's for him to explain, if he wishes."
"He hasn't decided whether to help us, has he?" asks Mektu.
Stilts gives him an ambiguous smile.
"You'll have to judge for yourself, I'm afraid."
"Maybe he's the one who's afraid," says Condry.
Almost imperceptibly, the Nadoman slows his step. He does not look at Condry, but his voice is distinctly colder.
"Let me tell you something, boy. After the killing at the Maghreb defile, when the enemy tired of pouring blackworms on our dying troops and marched off, General Tabasa slid down the side of that gorge and crossed a stream and clawed up the opposite slope. He found a stand of trees. He got a fire started somehow.
Then he stripped the gold brocade from his scabbard and heated one end of the wire in the flames. He lay on his stomach and drove that wire into the wormholes in the small of his back.
"Jashar!"
"Over and over," says Stilts, until he'd burned out all the worms and shriveled their eggs. When he was finished, his legs would not move, but if he hadn't, those creatures would have burrowed all the way to his guts, devoured him, left him hollow as a gourd. Shall I tell you the rest? He was found 2 days later by the Jathra folk of the Maghreb. He'd dragged himself to the outskirts of their village, through 6 miles of mountains, with just his arms. So spare me your thoughts about the general's courage. Is that clear? Condry nods. He can think of no retort. In his mind's eye, he sees the 2 severed heads. Exactly to order, sir. A man like that would kill them, too, without a moment's hesitation. Kill them, or deliver them to death. And yet Tabassa seems truly fond of Talupeke, and he had arranged for this doctor as well. The streets narrow. They pass a soup kitchen, browning onions, that heavenly smell. A temple, incense, frangipani, sage. An alley full of ragpickers, still asleep. Mektu is pressing his hand to his side. Piles on the devil's ass, Condry thinks. Why wouldn't Tabassa just explain his intentions? Why not just say, I mean to help you escape? Because he means to do nothing of the kind, says the voice of fear in Condry's head. But in that case, why bring them to the war council at all? Of course, one of them was not. The thought leaves Condry cold. Talupeke had spoken to the general about Mektu, and Tabassa had barred him specifically. Had he chosen a different fate for Mektu? This doctor, says Stilts, shattering his morbid thoughts, may insist on examining your eyes. If he does, well, there's nothing to be done except to get out of town quickly when you're finished. Don't try to bribe him. You can't. And don't lie if he asks you about the prophet. In fact, don't lie at all, except on one point. The brothers look at him quizzically. It's a simple matter, says the Nadoman. The doctor only treats patients he finds interesting. Everyone else can go to hell. So we had to make your brother sound interesting. And there's just one certain way to do that. We told him Mektu was a survivor of the throat rust.
The throat rust? Cries Mektu. What, you mean the plague?
The world plague, exactly. You had it last year and recovered. That's all we said to him, all we needed to say. You can fill in the rest as you like, but for the love of Ong, keep your story straight. This man's used to fakers. If you contradict yourself, he'll toss you out with your pants down.
But I didn't have the plague, says Mektu.
Stilt chuckles.
Sure you did.
What kind of doctor are we talking about, says Condry. My brother's flesh is rotting. He needs a wound treated, not some disease he never had.
You want him treated? Then stop jabbering and do as I say. We've had years to learn how these cuckoos think. Of course, they may not believe you. We'd like to scar your neck, as though you'd been clawing at yourself, trying to breathe. But you need at least a week for that. The bruises have to heal.
Scar his neck. Condry has a sinking feeling about the whole excursion. And Mektu is no different. Behind Stilts's back, he motions with his eyes. Let's just run. Condry shakes his head. They walk another 50 yards, then turn left at a corner. Before them is a curious alley, very long and straight between high and featureless walls. No people. No windows or balconies, just a small door at the alley's end, with a single torch beside it mounted in a sconce.
Excellent. No one's waiting outside, says Stilts. We were wise to come early.
Their footfalls echo strangely. The alley is devoid of other sounds. Also, oddly clean. Strangest of all, the door when they reach it is iron. Solid, massive iron,
like the door of a vault. Stilts steps up to the door and pulls a chain. Faintly, they hear the ringing of a bell.
"This is a hospital?" says Condry.
"Of course not," says Stilts. A slit opens in the iron door, framing two eyes. They appear to belong to a young woman, but there is something curious about their color, or their shape.
"I've brought case number 27, says Stilts. "Also an escort, his brother."
The eyes swivel.
"Turn around, 27. Chin high, if you please."
A woman's voice. An accent like nothing Condry has ever heard. The brothers glance at one another and slowly turn in a circle.
"Just the patient,"
snaps the voice. Condry steps back. This woman is used to being obeyed.
"Your throat is unblemished and symmetrical," she declares. "You haven't had the throat rust, 27. "You're wrong, I have," says Mektu calmly. "I lay in bed from the 1st to the 24th day of autumn. I couldn't speak for 20 days or chew food for 16. I lost 20 pounds. I ate papaya gruel and coconut water and goat's milk when I could get it. The papaya burned my throat, so for 4 days I drank straight from the coconuts. For the last 3 days, I slept propped against the wall. My teeth hurt, my bowels were empty. I felt as though a hand were inserted there and squeezing. My tongue swelled like a—
"Stop!" cries the woman.
"You're lying. You're just making things up. Find a local doctor or come back for our public clinic 3 weeks from tomorrow."
3 weeks, says Condry. "We'll be dead in 3 weeks.
"We?"
"He. I said he. I meant he."
Stilts turns away to hide his look of despair.
"I really did have the plague," says Mektu. "I thought you'd want specifics."
"Specifics, were they?"
says the woman.
"Go ahead, then. I took notes. Repeat those specifics. I am listening."
"I lay in bed from the 1st to the 24th day of autumn. I couldn't speak for 20 days or chew food for 16.
Mektu says it all again, smooth as a priest at morning prayer. Condry does not catch a slip. When Mektu finishes, there is silence from behind the door. Stilts glances at Condry, his eyes gone wide.
"Stand by for processing, 27,
says the woman. The window slit bangs shut. Gaping, Stilts leans close to Mektu.
"I don't know what the fuck just happened, but you're in, somehow. Well done."
He straightens, speaks normally.
"This is as far as I go. As for our next meeting, you've been warned to be punctual. Heed that advice."
He lifts a hand in farewell.
"The gods' luck be with you, gentlemen."
Condry, feeling a fool, takes Stilts's hand in both of his and squeezes it. He sputters,
"You're close to Telopeke as well, aren't you?"
Stilts raises his eyebrows.
"She's my sister's grandchild, if you care to know."
His face reveals no hint of encouragement. Condry drops his hand.
"Did you help her convince the general to aid us?" he asks. "As you yourself observed," says Stilts, "what he is convinced of remains to be seen."
He starts to turn away, but once more Condry stops him.
"Our names, Mr. Stilts. You said Telopeke didn't tell you, so how did you know to call us Hingemans?"
The Nottoman smiles, suddenly roguish.
"You feared that name had reached the streets already, along with your deeds."
"Nothing of the kind.
It's just that the two of you, standing there in the market, were like twin portraits of the man. Or competing portraits, maybe. One by a cold artist, an artist with a razor eye, the other by a wild exuberant. But in both of you I can see him plainly. I mean your father, that unbearable rascal. Ah, here's the nurse."
The iron door flies open with a boom and a strange hiss of air. Condry and Mektu shield their eyes. A dazzling light is pouring into the alley. So are guards, small men in spotless, sand-colored uniforms, closing the brothers instantly in a circle of gleaming spears. They pay no attention whatsoever to Stilts, who is already a good distance away. Condry wants to shout after him.
"You knew our father! Stop! Talk to me!"
but the spears press close, and the Nadoman is all but running. Bewildered, Condry turns to face the chamber again. There is the nurse, the owner of those eyes. Tall, elegant, impassive. Sky-blue uniform and skin of a pale amber-yellow. The guard's skin is identical.
"Welcome to the Zavacindran medical mission," says the nurse.
Zavacindrans? Of course. The best doctors in Uroth are not Urothis. He has heard the claim 100 times, but has never been close to one of these outlanders, has never glimpsed one, save for that single man in the crowd at Eternity Camp. Don't gape, idiot. They're just another kind of people, just one more clan. For the second time in a matter of hours, they are frisked and disarmed. Then the nurse waves them inside.
Quickly, 27. The door must not stand open.
The chamber is a stark, bright rectangle. There are two additional doors, one desk, 5 or 6 wooden chairs. A window behind the desk is covered with a fine metal grill, like chainmail nailed to a frame. What the hell can it be for? But even stranger are the lamps, which are innumerable and recessed into the ceiling, one every few inches, wall to wall. Their light is emerald-tinted and blinding. Condry cannot look at them for long. The door closes softly. There is a whirring sound, like a great beehive waking, and Condry feels a sudden pressure in his ears. The guards take up position around the walls of the chamber. The nurse extends an exquisitely clean hand, drops something into Condry's palm. It is a round plug of lead engraved with the number 27.
"Do not lose this coin," she says. "If you lose this coin, your weapons will not be returned."
Condry finds he can only nod. The nurse looks them up and down.
"By your expressions," she says, "I infer that you have never visited a mission before."
She glances at Mektu. "Or never been admitted." She slips into the chair behind the desk. She does not invite them to sit.
"Do you have a number too?"
Mektu asks, already leering. The woman ignores his question but asks many of her own, jotting Mektu's answers in a notebook. Condry listens agog to his brother's effortless falsehoods. Very soon he is angry, unreasonably angry, for at this moment his brother is only saying what he must. No, his anger is for other moments, other lies, for the years of small performances.
"You're a terrible actor, Condry."
"You've never understood, have you, Mech?"
"I was never acting at all."
"Dr. Scaris will attend you presently," says the nurse, without looking up. "The waiting chamber is to my left. You may proceed."
The chamber into which they pass is strangely chilly. There are 4 chairs, a second door, and a low table with an odd, globular structure. A mushroom, maybe, or a clot of worms. Dominating one wall is a large glass window. No daylight enters there. In fact, Condry can see nothing beyond it but darkness. With another hiss, the door shuts behind him. Mektu turns to Condry, his face transformed.
"We shouldn't have come here," he whispers. "They look like demons. This place is all wrong."
He is terrified. His behavior outside even more a performance than Condry understood.
"Enough nonsense, Mech. Your flesh is rotting, and the Zavacindrans are from across the ocean. Naturally, they don't look like us."
"Nothing is natural here," says Mektu.
"The lamps, that noise in the walls, and the cold in this room. It's sorcery. Not even Father could build this sort of thing."
"No, not even him."
"I don't want them touching me, Con."
"Not even that nurse?" He winks, desperate to lighten the mood. If Mektu panics, they will be tossed out yet. His brother glances at the door.
"I don't know. She was beautiful.
But what if they do something to me?" "All they're going to do is ask you questions about the plague. Now relax. This isn't sorcery. Chindelin said they had tools unlike anything in Uroth, and he heard it from the old man."
"Why don't they share it, then? If it's natural, why don't they show us how to make that sort of lamp?"
Condry hesitates. The quarantine? The fabled Zavacindran oath of non-interference?
"I can't explain that," he admits.
Princes play games with the world, and we're just the chips. Nobody explains things to the chips. It's wrong, but it doesn't matter today.
I'm not a chip, says Mektu.
You're sick, and they're going to heal you, says Condry. So don't piss the bastards off. Mektu paces. Condry tries one of the chairs, but jumps, startled, to his feet again. It is like sinking into a cake. He leans against the wall across from the window. He tries to distract his brother with something pleasant.
Tell me a joke, Mech. Give me that bit from the war choral about the old king and his swine.
But Mektu just remarks that the pigs end up as sausages. Condry moves on to Eshet.
She's become a little fond of you, I think.
Mektu's face brightens, but only for an instant. He says that Eshet has a husband in her village.
A husband? Eshet is married? Or a lover, anyway. She told me there's someone she's thinking about all the time.
Condry shrugs. That could be just about anyone. Her mother, or some favorite niece. Mektu shakes his head.
I bought her pussy for a night and forgot about it.
That doesn't help, Condry agrees.
She's no more fond of me than that nurse is.
He stops his pacing, lifts his hands to his temples.
It's back, he says. That feeling I had in the ravine that something horrible's coming? Let's just go, can't we, please, before it's too late?
Don't start that again, says Condry.
They might take something while I'm cut open. They might take my balls.
Good. You're not using them anyway. Mektu glares at him, says he isn't afraid. Condry smiles with one side of his mouth. But when Mektu's own expression hardens, he knows he has made a mistake.
I use them, says Mektu. I'm not the one who buys time with a girl and then just sits there like a luli.
Condry shuts his eyes. So Mektu knows about that.
What's the problem?
Asks Mektu.
You can't get it up? When you're finally alone with a woman, your candle melts? Is that it?
No, says Condry. And shut your vulgar mouth.
You should have told the girls to shut theirs, says Mektu. Ah, but you did. Didn't you? You probably even paid them. Otherwise the whole camp would have known.
But they told me because they were worried.
It's incredible. Even the whores were worried about Condry. You're the one people always worry about. And you have a go at my manhood.
It wasn't about that, Mac. Calm down for fuck's sake. His brother's chest is heaving. Condry cannot fathom what has set him off. Unless... He looks Mektu in the eye. Unless you really are in that kind of trouble. Pitfire, on top of everything else. Once again, Condry's face has given him away. Mektu looks at him, sneering.
Don't worry about me, he says. I'm just fine with women. And you know who could have told you that.
Don't you dare.
You should have asked her. Tell me, Harikina, do you sleep with my brother? Why didn't you just ask?
Condry feels a loathing settle deep in his limbs.
This freak. This twisted little shit who's plagued his life for 10 years. This mean-hearted, worthless, unwanted brother.
Yes, they could just walk out and go their separate ways. Condry could ditch him at the first street corner, leave him to his lies, let his wound burst like a pressure cooker, let him rot, let him go. His brother's face is defiant, but his jaw is trembling. He has gone too far.
You want to leave? Says Condry. Take our chances in the city? Find some Mab Makutin sawbones with ale on his breath?
Mektu blinks at him.
You mean it?
Condry doesn't know if he means it, but he knows he must beat Mektu at his own game for once. He grabs his brother by the arm and starts to drag him toward the door.
Come on! He snarls. There's a rusty knife with your name on it. Get your hands off me, says Mektu. You're right, says Condry, releasing him. I'm doing this the hard way.
He is almost to the door. Mektu stands rooted to the spot.
Where are you going? He says. On with my fucking life, says Condry, gripping the doorknob. Brother, says Mektu. I don't know what to do.
Condry looks over his shoulder. Mektu stares at him, beseeching,
Never in his life has Condry seen him so vulnerable, so crippled by doubt.
"Condry,"
he says,
"this place scares the shit out of me."
There is a blaze of light. Condry flinches. Mektu all but jumps out of his skin. It is the window, suddenly shining. Beyond it are eight seated figures, staring at them through the glass. The brothers recoil, as though caught in some indecency. Four women, four men, all of them studying the two soldiers with a quiet intensity, like theater-goers waiting for the show. Most are amber-skinned like the nurse and the security guards, but one woman is blacker than Chindelin, and one man, to Condry's slight disgust, is a pale gray with shades of pink, with veins clearly visible in his neck and forehead. All eight have notebooks in their laps. Condry, shaken to his senses, takes a few halting steps in their direction.
"Is one of you the doctor?" he demands.
No answer. Condry is not certain they can hear him. One of the men leans close to his neighbor and whispers, pointing at Mektu with a pencil. The man beside him nods. Condry feels a sudden revulsion for the figures. To be examined thus, with such indifference, the way a butcher might examine his hogs. Gods of death, what if Mektu is right? But look again. They are not all indifferent. One person in the back row, a short man with black, braided hair, seems positively anxious, fidgeting, frowning, glancing sidelong at the others. "What's wrong? What's happening?" Condry asks him silently, but the man will not meet his eye. The door near Mektu opens, and a smiling Zavacendran steps into the room. He is tall and graying at the temples. The effect is startling against his amber skin. He settles a pair of thick black spectacles upon his nose.
27, he declares.
It is neither question nor greeting. It is more formal than either. A labeling, perhaps.
"Yes, that's me," says Mektu. "I had the plague last year. I lay in bed.
I am Dr. Scaris, Epidemia Omnic. The plague last year, and thoracic trauma earlier this month.
An arrow.
Very good. The mission is glad to be of assistance in exchange for your interview. It is an equitable arrangement."
He turns to Condry.
"You are the brother escort. Will you please participate?"
Condry swallows.
"Of course,"
he manages to say.
"Very good. Elder brother or younger?"
"Elder. By just 3 days,"
says Mektu under his breath. There is a stirring among the figures behind the glass. Condry starts, looks over his shoulder. They can hear our every word.
3 days, says Scaris. "Your mother must have been exhausted. Were you tangled in the umbilicus?"
"Oh, no," says Mektu. "We were poor folk. We didn't use such things."
The doctor looks from brother to brother.
"Let's sit down," he says.
The interview is strictly physical. Age, diet, habits of exercise, hours of sleep. Most of the questions are for Mektu, and a good quarter of his answers are deranged.
"I can go 2 days without pissing if I want. I decided to stop seeing the color red."
Condry wants to kick him. The figures behind the window scribble furious notes. After some 40 minutes, Scaris takes off his glasses and just stares. Condry cannot decide if he is angry or defeated. Mektu, his mask of bravado very much in place, gazes back at him.
"You are a drug user, I think?" says Scaris.
Mektu nods solemnly.
"Mech!"
Condry forces a laugh.
"He's not serious, doctor. That was years ago, and even then it was just voha vipi, joy flowers. You chew them. Some people make tea."
"Kids' stuff."
"Exactly."
"I imagine the prophet put an end to that."
Silence. The eight behind the window look up from their notes. Scaris has had a good look at their eyes.
"Doctor," says Condry, "let me explain."
Scaris stands, gives a curt little bow.
"This interview is concluded," he says, and moves toward the door.
"Wait!"
cries Condry. He pulls up Mektu's shirt. The wound is bulging and hideously discolored.
"We answered all your questions,"
he says. You've got to help him. You promised. He's going to die.
The doctor's hand is on the doorknob.
Do you know why we come to Uroth, soldier of revelation? He asks quietly. To fight death. That is why. Not to conquer the next clan. Not to seize territory or demand revenge. Make no mistake, we are soldiers too. And missions like this one are outposts in a war. In our years in Uroth, we have eliminated two terrible diseases and driven a third almost to ground. But our true enemy, our mortal enemy, he still has the upper hand. I mean the throat rust, of course, the world plague. Have you ever watched a man die of plague?
I haven't, Condry admits.
Of course not, says Scaris. This continent is barely affected. Few Urothis ever contract the world plague, and those who do mostly recover on their own. Your resistance is almost supernatural. Only 1 in 8,000 Urothis dies of plague, but in the rest of the world? Have you any guess?
He slices the air with one hand.
Do not guess. I can stand no more chatter. The figure is 1 in 7.
Both brothers gape in horror.
Ong's sweet tears, says Condry.
Why? 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 Booms the doctor. That is the question that consumes us.
We are glad to treat your lesser diseases, your parasites, your foolishly neglected wounds. But our quest is for the secret of your immunity to the great butcher of mankind.
Uroth has a treasure for the world, sir.
But it is buried somewhere in this wilderness, buried in your pitiful disorder. We must dig for that treasure. Nothing else matters in the end.
My brother matters.
Scaris opens the door and stands aside. I said the interview was over, not your visit. Wait here, brother escort. 27. Kindly follow me.
They depart. The door closes, and the figures behind the window stand and rearrange their chairs. The new focus of their attention is the window on their left. Bright lamps have been lit behind it now, but from Condry's angle, the glass is merely translucent. Dimly, he sees his brother and Scaris entering the room, the doctor's gesture, Mektu unbuttoning his shirt. They stand thus for several minutes, the doctor bending closer to the wound. He can hear the faintest pulse of their voices. Then they move away from the window, and Condry can see nothing at all. But the watchers can see everything clearly. They are, Condry notices, all rather young. His own age or younger, probably. But who can be sure with faces like that? In any event, they have forgotten him. Whatever is happening to Mektu holds them transfixed. Condry begins to pace the room. Trust them. Miracle workers. Just look at these lamps. But that doctor was angry.
Yes, and who can blame the man? He's fighting the world plague, and Mektu lied through his teeth.
What about the general's odd remarks in that bunker, though? He wasn't eager to help us, and Mektu seemed to worry him especially. Is he looking for a way to divide us? Could the Zavacendrans somehow be part of that plan?
Condry thinks suddenly of Chindelin's words in Eternity Camp.
There's nothing I can do for your brother. I've tried, Condry. More than you know.
And again, the chaser. A feeling that scalds him with shame. The knowledge that he, Condry, would understand Tabasa's decision. For who in their right mind would consent to any journey with Mektu Hingeman, the unhinged clown?
Yes, he understands it. He could even forgive it, could he not? Even in some rotten wormhole of his heart, feel a certain gratitude? But the general does not know his heart. No matter his brother's idiocies, the general must have assumed that Condry would never abandon him, or take up with anyone who meant him harm. So what does a cold-blooded bastard like Tabasa do with that fact? Abandon them both? Abandon all the travelers? Or find a way to eliminate the clown?
a way Khandri will have no reason to connect with Tabassa himself. And if that is the plan, how fortunate, how perfect, that the clown is already in danger of death. But could Tabassa really have such sway with these foreigners? Could any doctor, foreign or Urathi, be so depraved as to kill a patient for the convenience of a warlord? Khandri freezes. Music. Someone is playing a piano, a jaunty and rather cloying tune. It seems to be coming from the wall opposite the window. He goes to the wall and touches it. The wooden planks vibrate on the low notes. A beer hall musician in a surgery. What the fuck? What the fuck? He sits down in a sponge cake chair. His fears are running away with him. You had to bring him here. You don't want some local jackass wielding that knife. Then, faint and distorted, he hears a voice shout,
No!
Mech?
No!
Khandri sprints to the door. Locked. Mektu is bellowing.
No, no, no! Get it away from me! Stop!
Khandri flies across the room to the door they entered by, then stops short. A dozen guards wait in that chamber. Mektu cries out again. Khandri grips the doorknob and turns. Locked. He hurls himself against the door. He runs to the window and pounds with both fists. He begins to shout at them, to demand they release his brother, to threaten and curse. The watchers do not spare him a glance. Mektu gives a wordless scream. Halfway through the rending cry, something muffles his voice. A hood, a mask, a pillow held down. Khandri goes to the table, lifts the round sculpture, hurls it at the window with all his might. The sculpture bursts in a thousand pieces. The window is not even scratched. He lifts a chair and swings it too, and only manages to crack its wooden leg. He is reduced to screams himself.
What's happening? What the living fuck are you doing to him?
He can see only one side of the watchers' faces. They lean forward, talking, gesturing, fascinated by the procedure. But one chair stands empty. The pudgy man with the braid has slipped away. Hours later, Khandri is slumped in the chair. No one has come. The watchers have drifted away. The room beyond the window is dark. His throat is raw from shouting. In his hands is a small brass plaque, the faceplate of the shattered sculpture. He stares at the neat Khasraji words, The human brain. It might as well be his own brain, there in shards under the window. He is brain sick, brain weary, undone by a presentiment of death. Mektu's death. A thing he has wished for sometimes, may the gods forgive him. A thing he will never recover from, if it should actually come to pass. It was Mektu who showed him how to scale a palm tree, hugging the trunk with all four limbs, a rope loop joining the feet. Mektu who taught him to play the fiddle, a five-song repertoire, the same five as Mektu himself. Mektu with whom he built a still in the loft of a neighbor's barn, from bamboo and glass milk jugs and an old oil drum. Mektu who shared his guilt when the barn caught fire, and the next 6 months rebuilding it, nail by nail. Mektu who carried him over the river Chev, his head cracked open, the Galsune arrows falling like rain. The screams have long since ended. The piano, however, plays on, faint and tedious. The tune changes, but the musician never pauses for more than a breath or two. No one claps, no one speaks or even clears a throat. It is as if there is no human involved, as if the keys are being struck by some tireless machine. And now, Jashar, is it possible? Yes, it is. The man is playing, butchering, his and Arikina's song. Give me one last hour with my true love, and keep your cold forever. Khandri laughs. Such a shameless kick in the gut. He leans back in the chair and pummels the wall. Play something else, you hear me? Play anything else! The tune does not falter.
Condry groans and covers his ears. For a few weeks that summer, the stories from Blind Stream became almost unbearably rich. First, the young Dr. Arikina vanishes. Then Condry Hingeman assaults a priest. Certain townsfolk came to the prison, knocked on the wall, shouted his name. It was not done out of solidarity, but merely to prove to themselves that it was really happening. When Condry answered, they had few words of comfort for him, but many questions. He answered with questions of his own, all concerning Arikina. The gossips put two and two together. The boy had clearly lost his mind, and what but love could account for it? Father Mars broke his silence only to confirm that Arikina had come to him with a crisis of virtue on the night of her disappearance. He made no mention of the cleansing ceremony. Surely the youths were lovers then, or fornicators, rather, brazenly defying the prophet's chastity edicts. But Arikina had repented, and it was to her credit that she had laid her guilt before the valley's elder priest. What form of atonement had Mars demanded? Some public humiliation? Whatever it was, the young doctor had balked, fled the valley in shame, and Condry had taken out his frustration on her confessor. All this made a salacious kind of sense. But then came the oddest twist of all, Mektu Hingeman's announcement that he and Arikina had been secretly engaged. It was more than an announcement. In fact, it was a performance. He wept out his heartbreak, rolled in the dust, cried to the gods to bring her back unharmed and take his own life instead. His speech borrowed liberally from the war choral and other poems.
Arikina! The cold mists have taken you. Come back, return the sun. You're the blossom of the valley, the woman of my destiny and dreams.
That his brother was dreaming was plain enough. Mektu's public agonies only underscored his guilt in Condry's eyes. He had spied on their lovemaking, and jealousy had driven him out of his mind. There was no other explanation. Who else but Mektu could have betrayed them to Father Mars? The first time his brother came to see him in prison, Condry had reached through the bars and taken a hopeless swing at his chin. But as the days wore on, a portion of Condry's fury was transmuted into awe. Deluded or not, his brother was doing some good.
"We had no carnal relations," Mektu told the villagers. "But I will tell you the truth, people. It took all my strength to resist her advances. Ari was feverish. I reminded her of our prophet's teachings on the matter of lust, and she heeded me. She went to Father Mars for moral correction and to confess."
"You?" asked a great many, bewildered. "Not your brother? Not the one who jumped the priest?"
Mektu bowed his head.
"Condry loves her too, of course. We were rivals, and he never could accept that I'd won. He's gone just a little mad. And somehow my poor brothers decided that it was Father Mars who swayed her, convinced Arikina to choose me. Don't blame Condry. Love makes fools of us all. I'm sure the good father has forgiven him already."
"Why did she run off then?" asked the skeptics.
"Don't you see?" Mektu barked at them. "She didn't run. She has no reason to run. She's still out there. Lost, hurt, caught in a wolf trap, pinned under a rock. We have to find her before it's too late."
This last claim, at least, he believed with all his heart, and his conviction persuaded more than a few. The search continued, and Mektu gave himself to it, body and soul. The wilder part of his fantasy, that Arikina had been his fiancée rather than Condry's lover, also had some good effects. It cleared the taint of promiscuity from Arikina's name. It even won some sympathy for Condry, would-be priest-killer, as the law pondered his fate. But the days wore on, and Arikina was not found. The search parties dwindled, then suddenly ceased. Mektu went on alone. Sometime on the 11th day, he too went missing. But before a new search could begin, word came that he had walked all the way to the tavern at Wolfkill and drunk himself into a stupor. When he returned, his story appeared somewhat tarnished. Perhaps Arikina had wanted to break off the engagement, if she had ever truly pledged herself to Mektu Hingeman.
Perhaps there was someone else altogether, in Nandipatar, maybe. Or brigands, kidnappers. The lands around Blind Stream had been scoured. Wherever the truth lay, it grew hard to credit that Arikina herself was lying in a ditch. Condry feared he really would go mad in that cell. Ari could not be dead. She had left the valley the way she had entered his life, in pitch blackness, guarding her secrets, hiding her tears. He knew now that his love for her was beyond anything he would ever feel again, and that to lose it would be to pass through this world condemned to half-measures, meaningless pursuits. He should have proposed months before. He should have stood watch outside the temple. He should have gone with her when she fled. He should be on the road with her that very minute, even if she refused him, even if she were bound for a place so strange and distant that it was hard to believe it could exist. Physically, matters could have been worse. His discomfort seemed paltry compared to that of the dogs, who bayed and whimpered through the nights. Condry at least had visitors. His mother came often, and so did all his siblings, save for Nireddy, who had not yet recovered from Ong's cunt. Several friends visited as well, with gifts of bread or sweets or lighted cheroots. Matches, of course, were not allowed in the cell. Most wanted nothing to do with him, however. Condry had assaulted a priest, a defender of the prophet's word. Heartbroken or not, he could only be shunned. His very first visitor, however, was Lantor Hingeman. The old man was disheveled and exhausted. His part in the search had been a hard ride to Nandipatar, and a frantic survey of everyone who remembered the girl from 6 years before. Afterward, he rode straight to the jail, contemptuous of visiting hours, and simply blustered his way past the guards. He stared at his son with similar belligerence. For several minutes, he did not speak at all. "Papa?" said Condry at last.
"What did she tell you?"
Condry stood up and walked to the bars.
"Ari? Nothing. She didn't say a damn thing. What's the matter?"
"You're not lying, are you, Condry? I won't forgive you if you lie about this."
"Lie!"
shouted Condry.
"Go to hell, Papa. I haven't lied to anyone."
His father waited. Condry threw up his hands, turned and kicked his cot, stormed back to his father and whispered,
"She's obsessed with Khosrowless City. And that plague doctor, what's her name, Serim?"
"Yes, of course," said the old man.
"But did she say nothing else?
Tell me the truth, I say.
On your life, Condry. On all our lives."
He was even more frightened than angry. But stranger than either was his odd look of guilt.
"What's going on here, Papa?" hissed Condry, seizing the bars. "Do you have something you should tell?"
The old man stood rigid. He raised a hand, trembling, and brought it near Condry's own.
"I have something I should never tell," he said. "And if you care about her, or your family, you'll never ask me about it again."
2 weeks later, Condry received a visit from Father Mars himself. The old man was escorted by a pair of younger priests and an army captain. He kept a good 6 feet from the bars.
"I brought you this," said the army captain, passing Condry a book.
He had a rather kindly face.
"Thank you, sir. Do you know what's to become of me?"
The captain shook his head. Then one of the young priests spoke up sharply.
"Father Mars wishes to know if you have anything to say to him, Condry Hingeman."
"Any groveling pardon to beg, that is." Condry looked the old priest in the eye. He could accuse the man right there, before that officer. But would it matter? Who was the more powerful, a young captain or a senior priest? And why did Condry imagine that this captain would wish to help him at all? They were busy men, impatient with his silence. If he did not speak quickly, they would be gone.
"Did you rape her, Father?"
It was a whisper, but it reached their ears. The younger priests all but burst with indignation. Mars restrained them with a gesture, his own eyes blazing.
"Jashar, is that what you think? What devil's mouthpiece whispered that in your ear?
His own sick fancy, said one of the younger priests. Let us go. This one will not avail himself of your kindness.